pretty, pretty. That's Kathy Tricoli and Wonderful, Merciful Savior, one of my favorite versions of that song. 11 and a half minutes after the hour, it's a Tuesday morning here along the Broken Road, and so we're joined by Dr. Don Clark, member of the Board of Creation Moments. Don is a biochemist and a vineyron and a groundskeeper. No, that's probably... Don, I have to tell you, I was on... Google Earth the other day, and I stopped by your place. You probably didn't see me.
No, I didn't.
First of all...
Were you looking from above?
Yeah, to begin with, because it zooms down, and I saw your vineyards. Then I walked back and forth on the highway back there, you know, right out in front of your place there. And it looks like a very nice place to live. I congratulate you on your choice. Looks like a nice environment to raise grapes and to while away the rest of your life.
Oh, yes, it's a very peaceful place. We've got mm-hmm. a little bit of hills around here.
Yeah.
We live obviously in Garden Valley, so we live in a valley, but mm-hmm. there's a hill obviously on other you know, around us, and the back of our property has a little hill. So, it's quite nice.
Okay, well, it's nice to know that stuff. Now we know a little bit more about Garden Valley, and it's a good place to base a Christian ministry, and it's a good place apparently to study about octopus. And that may be a weak transition here. I didn't know how else to get there here.
Octopi. Yes, we. I can honestly say we probably don't have a lot of octopus around here.
That's true.
Or octopi.
You're an educated man. What's the plural of octopus? Is it like fish?
I think it's octopi.
Octopi? Okay.
Yeah.
Yep.
That's kind of a Latin ending there.
You think it might be octopuses?
What's the plural of cuttlefish?
Be I treat it just the same as the word fish. Fish is the plural of itself. unless you're talking about different species, and then it's legal to say fishes.
Or squid. What about squid?
Squids? It would be squids. You wouldn't say squid eye, I don't think.
So what do all these have in common?
Good question. Well, they're all called cephalopods. Or
cephalopods.
Okay, I had the accent on the wrong syllable there, didn't I? Okay, well.
Yeah, they're all cephalopods, and if one were to ask what is the smartest animal in the sea, you might say dolphin, or you might say, you know, the big great blue whale or something along those lines.
Mm-hmm.
But did you know that the cephalopods are also considered quite smart because they have amazing abilities?
I watched a video within the past year sometime. It was just a camera focused on an octopus in a tank in an aquarium. And this octopus had been there for years and years and years and years. It had a name. I've forgotten the name. But as the camera recorded his jaunt, he climbed out of his tank. And left.
Escaped
octopus. Really? No, he didn't get far, and they put him back because he was kind of a local favorite there. But he actually figured out how to get out of his tank, and I don't imagine he could have survived for very long. But that impressed people. That people are going, we wouldn't have suspected an octopus of being able to do that. So there are surprises. There's some things we don't know about cephalopods, huh?
Well, we are just discovering, what gives them this tremendous ability to figure out things. And the octopus, for example, he or she has the ability. If you put food in a let's say a glass jar, he could figure out how to open the jar.
Mm-hmm.
Which is, kind of amazing. Obviously, he's got enough tentacles to manipulate, but to figure that out is really an amazing feat. And of course, you know about the octopus and being able to change the color of its skin to match the color of the background. so well that they're almost completely, you know, camouflaged. So what gives the octopus, as well as the squid, as well as the cuttlefish, for example, because they're all related and they all have this capability of doing these amazing, you know, amazing things? And to answer that question, one would have to say, well, obviously it's something in their DNA.
Well, and yeah, if you kind of the basic stuff,
you know, if you said that, you'd be partially right, but these creatures have another amazing ability, which a lot of other creatures and animals don't have, including us, and that is editing their RNA.
Now again, now, what's the difference between DNA and RNA?
Yes, it is. No, I mean.
Okay.
No, the so DNA, which stands for deoxyribonucleic acid, is the library of the cell, or, you know, it's your library. So okay. You go, if you want some knowledge, you go pick out a book, and you start reading the book. Well, DNA is kind of like that. If you need a new protein, for example, typically you would go to your DNA bank, DNA library, and say, hey, I need a new blood cell. I need a new blood protein. So you go to the DNA and say, you know, hemoglobin. I need a new myoglobin cell. So the cell then translates the DNA into RNA, and typically we call it a messenger RNA because it carries the code from the DNA into, instead of a double-stranded structure that the DNA is, into a single-stranded structure. And there's these other proteins or enzymes called ribosomes that latch on to the RNA and then begin to make copies of proteins. And so you go to your biology class and you start learning about DNA. This is what you're going to, you know, be told. That's how proteins are made.
Mm-hmm.
And so for every protein, you know, in your body, there's a corresponding section in your DNA that codes for the protein, and RNA is just this messenger molecule that carries this information from the nucleus of the cell into the cytoplasm, or into the area where these proteins are being made. Now, what's so different about the cephalopods? Well, the cephalopods take this one step further. The cephalopods can modify their RNA and make different proteins just by modifying their RNA. And so you don't need a one-to-one correspondence between this protein and the coding region of the DNA. You now have the ability to make different proteins based on your RNA. Now, this baffles evolutionists, because evolutionists say the way we get new features is by mutations of our DNA.
Uh-huh.
And that then would be translated with, you know, from with the RNA into this new feature that we're looking for. But these cephalopods have yet a more complex, structure, if you will, a coding, if you will, that their RNA also can be modified. So now you've got, you know, a very complex system. And it seems that every time we look at the DNA and the RNA, there's something amuck, and there's something that just doesn't quite fit the evolutionary story.
Mm-hmm.
And the more we look, the more we find, gee, this is amazingly complex, and it looks like, don't say it too loudly, but it looks like it's designed. It's specifically designed this way. And for the cephalopods, a lot of these proteins are in the nervous system of the cephalopod. So different types of proteins are being encoded, I suppose, and they haven't done the research yet to figure out why the RNA is being modified and what the end proteins are being used for, but they appear to be in the nervous system. And maybe that's why the skin can change colors so quickly, is because the RNA is much more responsive, let's say, to the environmental change than the DNA would be. Because if you have to get information out of your DNA, you've got to first send a signal from the outside of the cell into the cytoplasm, into the cell wall, your nuclear cell wall, for example, where the DNA is. That then needs to be translated into the RNA. The RNA has to unfold, and then you can copy that. I mean, the DNA has to be unfolded, so you can copy it, make a copy of an RNA. The RNA has to be translated outside the nucleus into the cytoplasm, and then you can make your protein, for example. But if the RNA itself can be modified, you've short-circuited that whole process, and you just need a signal from the outside of the cell, gets into the cytoplasm, that's the first step, and then that modifies the RNA so it can make the protein that you need very, very quickly.
Now, this is research being done at the Tel Aviv University, so it's coming out of Israel. And by the way, for listeners, there's a link in our chat window now. You can take a look at the same article that has prompted our discussion this morning. But the implication in the article seems to be that these cephalopods can alter their DNA at will. Is that correct? In other words, they can maybe think something or make a decision and then change their, for example, their skin color? I mean, apparently
it's highly related to their, you know, to their environment, and they modify their RNA, not the DNA, but mm-hmm. they're modifying their RNA, kind of at will. I mean, I don't think enough research has been done yet to see what triggers this, mm-hmm. Other than the fact that, hey, this is kind of strange, because we haven't really seen this a lot in other animals. But in these cephalopods, this particular feature is amplified, and a lot of their RNA has this ability to kind of self-edit, if you will.
Let me just read a short paragraph here, because this is kind of the nut of the matter. The Tel Aviv researchers found tens of thousands of such RNA recoding sites in cephalopods, allowing a creature like the octopus to essentially reprogram itself, adding, quote, new rifts to its basic genetic blueprint, unquote. In other words, these invertebrates don't care that they didn't inherit the smart genes. They make themselves smart anyway. That implies a matter of will, doesn't it? Or some other motivation that causes them to change that RNA, to alter it. To a purpose.
And now, smart, I mean, we normally think that, okay, you know, therefore, you know, if I think, therefore I am, or something along those lines.
Yeah.
I think that's stretching it a bit with regard to this, because it could be just, you know, environmental factors that are causing the, this RNA editing, if you will, as opposed to the octopus or the squid, for example.
Yeah, but who would have been watching that octopus on that video in the tank and have decided or somehow detected that he's thinking of escaping? Say what?
He makes some different type of proteins to help him think. I mean, to help him escape out of the tank.
Yeah.
To extend his tentacles, for example, or to add certain features that he needs to climb up the glass or whatever it happens to be.
Well, I think we as human beings need to look into this and develop this ability for ourselves. Right. This could be quite
now,
useful.
Now, here's this would be, that'd be interesting, because then, if, for example, we had the ability to change our skin color and our skin pattern.
Yeah.
I mean, I can see that you're wearing kind of a plaid shirt today.
Yeah.
You wouldn't have to wear the plaid shirt. You could just look like you have a plaid shirt on.
I could will myself to look plaid.
Yes. And then, you know, you could save yourself a lot of money because you wouldn't have to buy the shirt. You just think about, I want to wear plaid today. And then you've got a plaid shirt on.
I wonder if maybe I could will a thick coat of fur to deal with the East Dakota winter then at the same time.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. You could get a little furrier.
You know there is
an undercoat and you can have an outer coat. And you wouldn't need to go and buy, coats. This could be very, very valuable.
Have you ever heard of the term shapeshifter? It's a science fiction thing where a creature can change his structure and shape to look like anything he wants to look like. And I think of an octopus who can change color, and they seem to be very fluid, very malleable. I mean, they can get into little tiny places, and some of them, are huge when they're stretched out. And then these are amazing creatures to begin with. Who would have thunk it that they could change their RNA?
Well, that's right, and that's amazing. Now, the other thing about this, which actually really puzzles the evolutionist, is that those regions. So, you have to have DNA to code for the RNA to begin with, but the editable regions within the RNA are extremely conserved in the DNA. So, if there's thousands of these tens of thousands in the RNA, that means that there's tens of thousands regions in the DNA that don't mutate. They're protected so well from mutations that there's, the designer said this has to be extremely conserved and preserved in order to be able to allow the cephalopods, the octopus and the squid and the cuttlefish, for example, to have these abilities.
So this would prevent shape-shifting. In other words, it would preserve the kind.
It would preserve the kind, and it would baffle the evolutionists, because without modification of the DNA, you couldn't have new features, even though that's a big story, but, we're not going there this morning. But, so, you, in other words, if your DNA can't mutate, how do you get new structures and new features into a creature to evolve from one creature to the next? So this discovery, accidental or even purposefully, I don't know exactly how they went about it, helps to prove that we again have a designer for the system, as opposed to helping to support evolutionary biology. This helps to support creation, and that we were indeed created with these abilities from the very beginning, as opposed to evolving into this ability.
Now, we've talked on past programs about mutations in DNA. So now what we're saying is there are only limited areas of the DNA where such mutations are possible. Is that correct?
Yeah, well, in this organism, in these organisms, for example, that is very much correct, because I think one of the programs we talked about the mutation rate looking at the mutation rate for different animals and for humans, and then going back and calculating, well, okay, if we've got this type of mutation rate in these animals, how old are they? In other words, when did you have a pristine DNA where you didn't have any mutations? Mm-hmm. And we went through that calculation, and lo and behold, it's between 6 and 10,000 years, which, again, supports the young Earth creation.
That is, once we arrive back at the pristine DNA, that's how long it would take, given that rate of mutation, which happens generation after generation after generation. So that marks the beginning point, is the pristine, the original state of the DNA.
Right. Now, in these creatures, there are regions within their DNA that just don't change. They don't mutate. Mm-hmm. Now, whether they have extra proteins protecting them, what the exact mechanism is, I don't know. But histones are proteins that kind of wrap themselves around the DNA to protect it. So maybe these areas have yet an extra layer around that coding region that is, you know, variable within the RNA. But be that as it may, overall, these type of creatures would have less mutations than, you know, say, you know, some other creature that in the sea that doesn't have this ability.
Do you think that this is something unique unique to cephalopods then? Or might it be present in other organisms as well, and we just haven't detected it?
Well, I think it's probably more widespread than we realize. They do mention in the brief article, somewhere I remember reading it, that other animals have this ability, but to a much lesser extent. Mm-hmm. It seems to be enhanced in the cephalopods, but other animals and I think even us have the ability to modify our our RNA, but you know, tens of thousands of editable RNA, you know, regions,
sites,
seems like a large number. Mm-hmm. And so I think that was the point of the point of this article, that these creatures are special in that they have this ability to a large extent. Now, what typically happens in science is you find an example that is extreme. And in this case, it looks like this particular RNA editing is extreme in these cephalopods. And then once you find that, you begin to explore and say, okay, what about, does the mouse have this ability, or do humans have this ability? And sure enough, if you do the research, it may not be at the same level, but you'll probably find that, yes, indeed, even our, DNA, or RNA, excuse me, RNA would have this editing ability, maybe not to this extent. So, the extreme allows you to make the discovery, and then you begin to look more deeply into other animals or into us, for example, and say, "Hey, yes, this ability, we have this ability too."
But it allows for more than that, because if you apply logic here, if you apply evolutionary logic, all living creatures should have the same ability to modify their DNA according to environment or need, or however evolution is supposed to happen. But if there's a difference, that is, if cephalopods have a much more pronounced ability than humans or other animals, that speaks to a designer. That says there's a plan here that evolutionists are simply not taking into consideration.
Well, that's that's correct. That there was a need, for example, in this, for the survival of this of these organisms, to have this ability and to have more of it, for example, than in other species, or in other kinds, if you will. I don't want to talk about species here, but we'll talk about kinds. So, in other kinds, you may not have the need. For example, change color, or to change to look like a stone, or to look like grass, so you could hide yourself. Because the octopus, I mean, other than its tentacles, is pretty soft and squishy. And, there's a lot of creatures that would like to eat it. And so if it can camouflage itself and look like a rock, then it would obviously have an advantage over, let's say, it's a big gray thing sticking out on a dark seafloor or something.
Interesting.
So, anyway, this this points to, it seems like, the more we look into the DNA and the RNA story, the more we see a designer, and the less we see of this is impossible. I mean, evolution cannot explain these things.
There are, as an article in National Geographic that I just found, that there are seven organisms that change gender. And I haven't, I've just opened the article, and I don't know if they do it at will, or if there's a, if there's responsive. One of them that's listed is the cuttlefish. There's a parrotfish as well. There's a couple of land animals that also change their gender. What is this? This looks like hyenas. I think that what you said. I'm gonna sneeze.
Okay, Gesundheit. All right, there you go.
It's the article says I'm gonna sneeze. Mm-hmm. No, it's got that done. But it's the there's a kind of a squid that changes gender. This particular research says that it puts the kibosh on unwanted male attention.
Huh. Well, I guess it would.
Garter snakes have some sort of an ability, or perhaps, and the notion of hibernation, that the organism goes into a cave and the organism, I'm trying not to put a free will aspect on this creature, but they go into a cave and go into a deep sleep. So they slow down their body processes, and sometimes it happens on a regular basis, sometimes not.
The change of gender you're talking about. Yeah.
Well, I'm talking about hibernation.
Oh, okay.
or changing gender. I mean, there's two different aspects.
Mm-hmm.
There are kinds of rabbits that change their color, and there's a kind of a salamander that will change its color to blend into the background. I mean, there's just all kinds of these.
These folks at Tel Aviv University have a lot more work in front of them than they thought.
There's more, and the the article. If you click on the article that you sent over, Don, you click on the names of the people. The article is also in Cell Magazine.
Journal.
That's the word. The journal, and then it's also in the New York Times. So I mean, it's getting some coverage, but not as extensive as maybe it sounds. Do you know when this study happened? The seven gender altering animals article was posted in 2013. So it's fairly recent.
Let's see. April, it was published in the Journal of Cell, April 6th this year.
Mm, okay.
So it's relatively new.
It's fairly new information. This may sound like I'm changing the subject, but it's kind of the same topic. There's a new book out called The Darwin Conspiracy, and it's historical. Yeah. It's historical fiction, but the characters that the author talks about in the book actually lived. And there's this Fitzroy, the captain of the Beagle, and Robert McCormick was the captain, or the ship's surgeon. That was also a competitor with Charles Darwin in collecting species, and was sending back species. And there was a bit of a competition between Darwin and McCormick as to how often they could send the species back, who would send them back, and this was all under the auspices of the English government. The story goes on towards the end of it that Fitzroy and Darwin and McCormick and a young guy from Tierra del Fuego, whose name is Jemmy Button. Now, that's not his real name, but I don't remember his native name. But he was a young Indian kid that was captured by Fitzroy in a previous expedition. And Button wanted to take them back to meet his tribe and his father. And when they went back to the tribe, they found themselves in this cave where the father explained to them how life worked and where life came from. And he described the tree of life theory. Now, granted, this is historical fiction, granted that Darwin didn't write his book until, 9 years afterwards?
It took,
and,
yeah.
You know, yeah. It took him a long time, and there's still a lot of maybe not confusion, but controversy about where the theory came from. And the book suggests that it came from this native in Territorial Fuego in a dark cave in the middle of the night sometime, with a campfire roaring away in the center, and he's drawing pictures on the side of the walls, and he's describing that all organisms, all life, comes from a single cell amoeba or a single cell critter that is way down on the bottom of the tree of life, and then all other forms of life spring from this single cell, this small critter, up the trunk, onto the leaves, onto the branches, and all the rest of it. Starts to sound familiar, doesn't it?
Yeah, the study, the research on Darwin, how he came by this theory, is fascinating, because there are others that say he's plagiarized it.
And there are others. Alfred Russell, I think, was the other guy that had developed something similar to that, mm-hmm. or the similar notions. But Darwin was the one that was able to publish it and was able to get his name out there. Mm-hmm. Some say that it was just because he got to the press first. Others say that there were he had help from the organization that he happened to be in, and I've forgotten the name of it now, but it was the Royal Expeditionary Gathering of Explorers. Mm-hmm. But what an interesting little story.
I can imagine some tribal shaman somewhere in South America that had developed this, or it had been passed on to him over the years, and that this is how it started, because I suspect the scientists would have given it some credence as the originators of the thought. You know, this is the most primitive encounter they've had with any theory of development of species, and they would probably give it more credibility than we would if we found it today. So anyway, interesting stuff.
Yeah, probably. But it was an interesting theory, and I got to that point of the book, and I said, wait a minute, I'm looking for some sort of other conspiracy. I'm not looking for somebody that ripped off an idea that he heard around a campfire somewhere. I'm thinking of like conspiracy where somebody got killed, or somebody got murdered, or somebody got a published manuscript, and then he took his magic eraser and rubbed out the guy's name and put his own name.
Dollars and reputation didn't get involved until the book was published.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And it was the promise of that notoriety, that fame and fortune probably, that stimulated a lot of that writing that went on.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot less than scientific thought, although that was part of it too, I think.
Yeah, interesting book, though. It was, and I kept going to other sources to find out if the character or the activity he was writing about was an actual real character that has historical significance. Mm-hmm. And in most cases, just about everybody in the book has an historical role to play, at least in the 19th century.
Yeah, interesting stuff. And again, this article is available through the link in the chat window at BrokenRoadRadio.com if you want to take a look at the article. It's a short one. It's easy to read. And it starts out by asking, what's the most intelligent animal on the planet? And it goes to some length in trying to answer that. I think you find it interesting. Dr. Don, as always, we're grateful to you for the time you've spent this morning and your analysis here. Thank you for your expertise. Don is a biochemist and member of the board again at Creation Moments. I want to mention their website, creationmoments.com is the website. And you can learn a lot by going there. It happens to be like a library of the scientific evidence for the biblical story of creation, as opposed to evolution. I think you find it fascinating and mind expanding, really. It really does. Don, thank you so much.
Oh, you're quite welcome. And you folks have a great week.
You too. We'll see you next
week.
You
as well, Don.
Bye-bye.
So long.